Welcome to the Geriatric Journal Club, featuring practical discussions on the front line of PALTC issues that you wrestle with every day. The Geriatric Journal Club is a joint presentation of the Colorado Journal Club and the Society for Post-Acute and Long-Term Care Medicine. References for this podcast and links to previous recordings can be found at paltc.org/journalclub. Support for this podcast is brought to you by Avadem Health, the makers of the TheraWorks Protect U-Pack.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Geriatric Journal Club. November 7th, 2019. My name is Travis Neal, and I'm a PA practicing in post-acute care and assistant to the medical director for Vivage. Today's topic is on antibiotic stewardship. So as most of you are probably aware, we're coming up to the deadline here at the end of the month for all long-term care facilities to have a stewardship program in place. So we thought this would be good timing to talk about some of the influences, the social influences of human behavior, because as we've learned that education alone with antibiotic prescribing is not enough. So we're going to have two articles that we're going to talk about today. The first article, I'd like to introduce Dr. Clay Watson. Dr. Watson is the Optum Medical Director for Complex Care Management in Colorado. He is an infectious disease doctor, so we're especially lucky to have him on with this topic. He's got 10 years of experience in infectious disease. He was also a hospitalist and director of an infection control for large hospital systems. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Watson to talk about his article, which is What is the More Effective Antibiotic Stewardship Intervention? Prescription Authorization or Post-Prescription Review with Feedback? Dr. Watson?
Thanks, Travis, and good afternoon to everyone. Thank you for taking time to listen in. Travis and I talked about this topic a little bit in advance. Mainly, you know, for the last 5 to 10 years, antibiotic stewardship has been a big topic. It's kind of been forced on us. And if I may say, it is a drum beaten often and sometimes too often. And no, it's a topic near and dear to my heart. I even catch myself with a little bit of an eye roll or the internal groan at the mention of another antibiotic stewardship program talk. And so we were hoping to do something slightly different. We didn't want to just parade 75 different reasons why you should participate or you should have one. There are plenty of studies out there, and I'm sure we're all aware of the benefits to patients, financial benefits to institutions, environmental benefits, as well as the inherent idea of self-preservation. Mainly, I want antibiotics around when I'm sick, and we don't want to just sit there and develop resistance. And then finally, as Travis just mentioned, CMS now makes it required. So we have to do it. And I think the knee-jerk reaction, and in fact, a very effective strategy has been, okay, we're just going to restrict these antibiotics, and you have to call and get approval for them. And that has been shown to be effective in reducing antibiotic use. The problem with that sort of one person to approve all, or as J.R.R. Tolkien would say, one ring to rule them all, we can't have any collaborative conversation. It sort of it sets up a ruler and a ruled dynamic, and it can build animosity. Nobody likes being told what to do. And we already have all these do's and don'ts. And so I don't want to see a program that kind of works but contributes to burnout, right? I want to see a good, effective program that promotes long-term learning. And so hopefully Travis and I today can illuminate a better way forward and perhaps a more effective way to do antibiotic stewardship, either in concert with restriction or perhaps in replacement. And so you can see there the article I chose, What is the More Effective Antibiotic Stewardship Intervention? And you might hear me refer to it differently. Really what I'll say is antibiotic restriction or pre-prescription authorization versus post-prescription review with feedback. That's kind of audit and feedback. So no restriction or no limitation on initial prescribing, but we're going to follow up and talk to you after you've done it. Feedback can come in several forms. This paper used an antibiotic stewardship team to call all providers within 72 hours of initial prescriptions. However, I think Travis is going to talk about different ways to provide feedback, and hopefully one that's even simpler and easier than we see in this paper. Okay, so what's this trial? Really, essentially, it's a crossover trial. We're comparing two different ways of doing something. And so we have two teams here. We'll say Team A and Team B. Over a four-month period of time, Team A was under the antibiotic stewardship of pre-prescription authorization. So they had to call to get approval to use broad-spectrum antibiotics. Again, this was over 4 months. And then Team B got the post-prescription review. So that's the call within 72 hours to discuss the case, clinical findings, and perhaps change the antibiotic use. And then we had a one-month washout period. So initial Team A, Team B for 4 months, one-month washout period, and then the teams switch methods. So Team B goes to pre-prescription authorization, and Team A goes to post-prescription review and feedback, or audit and feedback. So that can help eliminate some of the biases of seasonality, because everybody is participating in each type of intervention. We had appropriateness scored according to Johns Hopkins Hospital guidelines. This took place at Johns Hopkins Hospital, which is about 1,200 beds. The study period was September 2013 to June 2014. This is a large teaching hospital, as you know, with many, many house staff and other important things to know. Prescript authorization were really the broad spectrum antibiotics, or those with a high side effect profile. I always think of some of the antifungals that are really miserable to take, or things like aminoglycosides also can be very damaging to hearing and kidneys. So all of those were the restricted antibiotics. The major outcomes we're looking at here are days of antibiotic therapy. And so really think about the antibiotics. So 1 day of therapy equals one antibiotic administered to a patient. So on day one, if a patient got three different antibiotics, that's 3 days of therapy. Important distinction there. So we're looking at antibiotics with days of therapy. And then this was all normalized to patient days or days of therapy per 1,000 patient days. Secondary outcomes are length of therapy. So that's specific to a patient. So no matter how many antibiotics they got, how many days were the patients on antibiotics? Other secondary outcomes, symptomatic Clostridium difficile colitis within 60 days, length of hospital stay from day one of antibiotics, as well as in-hospital mortality. So those are the outcomes we're looking at. When we look at the patient population, the admission to the teams were similar. Many of us have been house staff, and we realize how tightly we watch that. So that is not to be a surprise that residents were making sure that no other team was getting less patients than them. In this period of study, 778 on Team A and 730 patients on Team B all had antibiotic therapy. The most common indications over both arms were, number one, urinary tract infection, number two, community-acquired pneumonia, and number three, skin and soft tissue infections. And I think, though this is a big hospital system, we often see those infections in long-term care as well. So fairly applicable in terms of types of infections we're treating. Antibiotic therapy was adjudicated by two infectious disease doctors based on the Johns Hopkins Hospital guidelines, as compliant or non-compliant. 34% in the pre-prescription authorization were deemed non-compliant and 41% in the post-prescription review and feedback. And that makes sense, right? Prior authorization has its effect up front. Review and feedback obviously comes later. The most common reason was that no antibiotic was indicated. So during the first 4 months, days of therapy remained steady on team A. So in the pre-prescription authorization, we got our intervention, but then over those next 4 months, the days of therapy didn't really drop at all. And so it was 365 days per 1,000 patient days at the beginning of the 4 months and ended 366. So roughly the same. However, on team B in the post-prescription feedback arm, the days of therapy decreased steadily over the 4 months. So dropping from 365 down to about 345 per 1,000 patient days. So right up front, we see that the prescription, post-prescription feedback demonstrating greater effect. So then we had our 1 month washout period and the teams switched. So was this a team effect or does the method really matter? And what do we see? On team A, now on the post-prescription review and feedback, again, we get the steady decrease. Now from 360 days of therapy per 1,000 patient days down to 350. And team B, who had had such a great improvement, on post-prescription feedback authorization, now that they're on prior authorization, essentially, they stayed constant, right at 350 all the way through the 4 months. So the median days of therapy per 1,000 patient days in the two groups, and again, remember, this is looking at antibiotics. So the pre-prescription authorization, you had 8 days as the median, and in the post-prescription review and feedback, you had 6 days. So you had fewer days of therapy. And then again, the median length of therapy, now looking at patients, how long did they receive any antibiotics? In the prior auth, you got 7 days. And then in the post-prescription review and feedback, you only had 5 days of therapy. In their other clinical outcomes, that's C. diff, length of stay, and in-hospital mortality, no difference at all between the two groups. So overall, what do we see here? We see a continuous improvement in the post-prescription review and feedback, and in fact, a greater magnitude of effect over just 4 months' time. And if we stop and think about it, you know, pre-prescription authorization, it's good. You get, you're ensuring the best choice of antibiotic up front, and you can limit exposure to antibiotics when it's not indicated. However, all your intervention is up front, and so you can't really help beyond that. It's very resource intensive, and you can't impact length of therapy. In addition, you can't restrict every antibiotic, so you're only impacting a few antibiotics. In the post-prescription review and feedback, it functions more like a mini consult in this case, right? There's more data available. It impacts antibiotic prescribing. It impacts all different antibiotics, and it impacts length of therapy. It could be seen as a time-consuming because of the data collection, and it really doesn't have much impact up front. And so I think what the authors talked about in this study and what we can see, this is definitely, if it's paired with pre-prescription authorization, it is a fantastic way to have a greater effect. But if you're resource limited and you could only choose one, I would lean towards post-prescription review with feedback. As someone who had to hold the antibiotic approval pager for a large county hospital in Houston, it's a fairly miserable experience to get multiple calls in the middle of the night from every team, medicine, surgery, ICU, asking to use antibiotics. not just getting woken up, but getting yelled at as to why they can't use this antibiotic. They start out annoyed, and then they just rapidly escalate to full-on nuclear angry. So I would not recommend, or at least I wouldn't want to be that guy holding that pager. But I would be happy to be the post-prescription review and feedback, because it really is a much more collaborative process. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Travis, and he can help us understand even a better way to give some feedback.
We will return to our interview after this brief message from Avadem, the creators of TheraWorks. What are you missing to drive better outcomes for recurrent UTI patients, from mounting antibiotic-resistant concerns to unproven over-the-counter remedies? Your options for preventing urinary tract infections in post-acute care facilities have been limited until now, safe for a variety of urogenital uses and won't contribute to resistance. The TheraWorks Protect UPAC is the safe, clinically proven, convenient hygiene solution you've been missing. To learn more about how the UPAC can become part of your UTI prevention protocols, visit seewhatsmissing.com.
Wonderful. Thank you, Dr. Watson. I really appreciate that. And I will be echoing some of the of my own experience, at least, with antibiotic stewardship. So my article that I chose is titled Effect of Behavioral Interventions on Inappropriate Antibiotic Prescribing Among Primary Care Practices. The gist of this study was they implemented up to three different interventions over an 18-month period. So there's the control group, which got no interventions, and then one, two, or three interventions. It was randomly done, and all clinicians received education on antibiotic prescribing prior to enrollment. Then the interventions that were implemented was, the first one was a suggested alternative, so a pop-up basically in the EHR when you entered an antibiotic saying, hey, have you thought of these different alternatives? The other second intervention was an accountable justification. So they had to, it was mandatory, they had to put in a reason for the antibiotic. And the important part of that, I think, was that it was publicly displayed. And then number three was peer comparison. So the results of the study were that compared to the control group, so all groups had an improvement in basically from inappropriate to appropriate antibiotic prescribing. However, the all three interventions had statistically significant differences from the control group. So a difference in the suggested alternatives of it's at a 95% confidence interval, and it was an absolute difference of negative 7.8%. The accountable justification was negative 9%, and the peer comparison had an absolute difference of negative 16%. So a couple limitations of this study I think are important to mention. The number of clinicians within each cluster was small. The results are dependent on EHR and billing data, which can be inherently flawed. For example, the diagnosis chosen by the clinician, which could have been inaccurate, like choosing a non-specific URI instead of pneumonia, which could have simply been a mistake by the clinician. Other such data integrity problems are inherently part of any data analysis involving EHR and billing data, but there were no specific data integrity problems identified. The logistic and nonlinear regression models may lead to effect sizes biased toward the null in randomized studies when important covariates are omitted. And it did not measure heterogeneity of interventions by type, practice, clinician, or EHR product. Finally, it did not describe what constituted inappropriate antibiotic prescribing, which is loosely defined as not guideline concordant. So inappropriate could be missing documentation, wrong dose, wrong duration, or completely inappropriate to prescribe at all. The general conclusion from this study that it was a pretty good study looking at behavioral interventions. It involved 248 prescribers and over 16,000 visits. The behavioral interventions were modest changes to the practice environment, and they involved behavioral science concept known as a nudge, which I'm going to talk about here in a minute, as none of the interventions restricted the clinician's choice of treatment or changed how they were paid. The results were that all of the behavioral interventions reduced inappropriate prescribing practices by a statistically significant amount over the control group. But while none of the interventions were statistically significant between each other, the most effective ones appear to be socially motivated. For example, the accountable justification one that was publicly displayed, there are other studies that have been done involving accountable justification where it was not publicly displayed, and it actually did not have a statistically significant difference. So when you just posted it so that everyone could see it, that's what changed the behaviors the most. And then peer comparison data, which is what I'm going to talk about in more detail, consistently shows favorable outcomes on behavior modification. So my experience has been supporting Vivage with antibiotic stewardship reviews for a little over a year now. And I've been looking at 12 facilities, roughly 63 prescribers, approximately 150 to 200 reviews per month. For the first 3 months, I tried purely education. And I think anybody that's been doing this for any amount of time realized that that actually doesn't work. I sent each provider criteria, and that the criteria was worked on by Dr. Gom and other medical directors, which we kind of all agreed were a reasonable compromise, if you will, between the McGeers and the Loebs, and more catered towards long-term care. And so it was based on evidence-based medicine. And this was when to use antibiotics for UTIs, pneumonia, skin, cellulitis, wound infections, conjunctivitis, and C. diff. So initially, I tried asking providers in various ways to read the reviews and the criteria and modify their practice when they felt it was appropriate. This had basically no effect. The next thing I tried was having the reviews distributed by the medical director, administrator, and the DON, and having them request that providers read and modify where appropriate. We let the providers know that the reviews were purely educational, and we just kind of used stronger language indicating that we really wanted them to read them. This had a slightly modest effect on behavior change. So then we tried requiring a response to the reviews. So even if they disagreed with the recommendation, we just asked for some kind of response. This was basically met with a fairly negative response from providers, complaining about the additional time it took to review and respond, and really just more contentious responses. So we stopped doing that, requiring responses. The next thing I tried was identifying the problem prescribers, and then had I was assigned to be sort of the antibiotic steward for timeouts for those providers. So I would discuss their antibiotic prescribing and criteria with them on the phone after they prescribed an antibiotic. So I will echo Dr. Watson's experience, although I'm sure not to the same degree. It was basically miserable. It was one contentious conversation after another. And no matter how I seemed to try to present it, basically I just felt like I was pushing people back into their way of thinking and their camps even more with all of the conversations. And I did not see much change in the percentage of inappropriate use. So finally, I began creating comparison graphs showing antibiotic days of use and inappropriate days of use. And that was in the numerator. And then I added a facility factor for the denominator. So while this isn't perfect, the facility factor is the average number of patient days per month per 1,000 patient days. So it gives a factor based on the size of that facility. So it allowed for a little bit better comparison between facilities. I summarized the data by provider, by facility, and I compared those monthly. The providers were assigned numbers to make the data anonymous, and providers with inappropriate use less than 20% were labeled as top performers. These graphs were sent out for the first time 3 months ago, and as of this month, I have noted an average decrease in overall use and inappropriate use by an average of 25 to 40%. And statistically, by far the biggest response I've ever seen with any of the interventions that we've tried so far. So we need more time distributing the comparison data, and it is limited in that it doesn't account for the number of patients a provider sees at a building compared to other providers. But since we are evaluating percentages it is a reasonable comparison, and the results are by far the best I've seen so far. So even though the data is anonymous, providers can see where they stand with respect to their peers, and it's non-confrontational. It is purely for educational purposes, and it gives them a benchmark. So first, it gives a positive spin on things. It says, here are the top performers, and it gives positive feedback to those top performers. And then it gives the other providers sort of a benchmark with which to compare themselves without any change we don't require any change in decision-making. So they have total autonomy to make whatever decisions they want. And so, the common strategies to change behavior can really be categorized into, like Dr. Watson mentioned, persuasive and restrictive. And the traditional audit and feedback with some element of public display are the most effective. Non-punitive peer comparisons are particularly effective to nudge providers toward changing their practice style. And so if you're not familiar with nudge theory, I'm not going to go into too much detail, but it is a fascinating read. It's by a gentleman, him and his partner, and it's Richard Thaler. And Richard Thaler he wrote a book, and then he actually won the Nobel Prize in economics for his theory. And the basics of the theory is it proposes positive reinforcement and indirect suggestions, which can have powerful influences on behavior and decision-making. So the most famous example that he had in the book was the 401k example, where they struggled to get percentages higher than about 45 to 50% of people to sign up for 401ks. And they theorized it had to do with how much work was involved in signing up. So they flipped it. They said, well, you can sign this paperwork if you want to opt out, but if you don't do anything, then you will automatically be signed up at this rate and you will be invested this way. And the percentages went from the 45 or 50% up to 85 and almost 90%. So it was significant. And the other one that I enjoyed in the book was the fly in the toilet, where they actually drew a little fly inside a toilet just next to the center of the urinal. And the difference in terms of how much they had to clean up was statistically significant, according to those that ran the study. And so just given a target, it made a huge difference. And in our example here, the target is the top performers. So you have something with which to compare yourself in a benchmark. The other message that I would give to medical directors and providers out there is that you can make this fairly simple. In fact, the more simple the graphs are, I would even leave out much, if any, wording. I would just have basic, simple graphs that do the comparisons and let them take a look and decide, if they want to look at the details of the data to determine why they were in the percentages they were. The other effective thing that Dr. Gom and I have spoke about before is that in terms of restriction, the one effective strategy that I have seen in nursing homes is having the director of nursing as really your gateway for prescribing antibiotics, and actually more specifically for testing. And given that urinary tract infections are kind of the low-hanging fruit in nursing homes, I think the most effective change I've seen is when a director of nursing is in charge of whether or not to order a UA. And if everything has to go through them and they're educated on what to look for, that seems to have one of the more powerful effects on reducing antibiotic use. In essence, positive reinforcement, focusing on leaving the decisions up to the providers, so at the end of the day, they can make their clinical choices based on their own judgment, but giving them some comparison had a very profound effect on behavior change.
Support for this broadcast is provided by Avadem Health, the creators of TheraWorks Protect.